Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor John Kasich has cut two deals recently with the owners of the casino operation set to open in Ohio over the next few years. The deals have inspired threats of a lawsuit by the Ohio Roundtable, which claims that changing the terms at this point is unconstitutional without the vote of the people. Joining us now to lay the groundwork is Dispatch reporter Joe Varden. Joe, welcome to the show.
Ann, thanks for having me. And it's quite appropriate that this is the topic of our conversation, given what we were just listening to before with the conversations about the Boston mob and the Italians and the Irish. And I think they even play a little Rolling Stones as a bridge at some point. So fits right in.
And later on, we'll be talking about Shakespeare, who, you know, has dealt with all of these issues as well 400 years ago. Also with us is a Professor Richard McGowan. He is the Carroll School of Management at Boston College. He's author of 5 books, including Government and the Transformation of the Gambling Industry. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Good to be with you.
So, Joe, let's give us a primer on those two deals. Are they the exact same deal for both companies? And if not, how do they differ?
Well, it's important to know that they are the same now, because what the governor signed with Penn National, his most recent deal, circles back and applies to Rock Ohio Caesars. There were a few minor differences in terms of how much money the casinos would be required to pay or to pump into their own facilities, a little bit less with the Penn deal. And there were a few other minor issues, but basically they were the same.
What about the racetrack issues? Mm-hmm. How do those figure in?
Well, I mean, the racetrack issues were a very large component of the negotiations, fighting over terms related to not only how much the racetracks would have to pay for license fees and taxes on slots at their tracks, but also issues related to would they be able to move their tracks elsewhere in Ohio. So that was certainly part of the deal. But I think it's also part of the deal in the sense that because we have casinos, that affected how much the governor was going to seek on these licenses for slots at the racetracks. When that was first an issue back in 2009, the state didn't have casinos, and you didn't know whether the electorate was going to allow those. So the times were different. Here, if taxes were higher for racetracks, you could argue that those racetracks just wouldn't be able to compete and stay in the game with the casinos.
Professor, listening to Joe talk, you get the sense of the domino effect of all of this. When you set up one kind of business, it's going to affect all the other businesses, particularly when we're talking about gambling.
Yeah, I mean, there is a cannibalization effect. And one of the problems here is that, you know, even when you talk about a casino, on average, you're probably talking about 70 to 80% of the revenue from a casino comes from slot machines. And so, you know, when you allow slot machines in the racetracks, they really do compete with each other, and especially for the most profitable part of a casino, which are slot machines. And so you're putting them all over the place, and so they're certainly going to cannibalize one another.
What about the entire Midwest? When we're looking at what our expectations are in Ohio, we're almost last on board now in the Midwest. Joe, what are they expecting? There's lots of chit-chat about what are we really going to get out of all this in the end?
Well, one of the biggest components of what the gambling expert that the governor hired to advise him, one of their biggest contributions to this whole thing was a giant report that shows what Ohio can expect from gambling, at least in terms of the casinos themselves. And this report showed that Penn National stands to have essentially a more profitable casino in Columbus than just about any of its other properties. And Wall Street shows Ohio as perhaps the best market for gambling, at least regionally. And some of the other firms on Wall Street show that Ohio will be among the best. So the expectations really, at least according to this report, are quite high.
Professor, how do you determine whether a state is going to be good for the business or not?
Well, I think what you look at is your neighboring states. So, for instance, I mean, if you look at the neighboring states from Ohio, clearly Indiana, if you look at their casinos are all on the Ohio border. And in fact, the 14th largest casino market in the country is Lawrenceburg Rising Sun, Petra, Indiana, which is right on your border. So clearly what's going on there is that right now, currently, there were many Ohioans going over there to gamble. And so basically what Ohio is trying to do is reclaim gambling revenue. And so, you know, you have that. By the way, I'm originally from the Philadelphia area. I'm from Pennsylvania. I mean, Pennsylvania is a clear example of a state. It's now housed the third largest gambling revenue in the country outside of – and clearly it has regained revenue back from New Jersey. And so that's an interesting thing. I mean, so in other words, basically what you're doing is you're trying to reclaim the gamblers from other – that are going over to other states, and that's what you're doing.
And the location of the casinos is very strategically placed, right, Joe? Joe?
Yeah, I mean, especially just for the as far as the Columbus market is concerned. I mean, without having the map in front of me, I'm not sure what the exact mileage is, but you've got quite a bit of distance between, the Cleveland Casino and the Cincinnati Casino, and certainly the Toledo Casino, and then more regionally, I mean, Detroit is quite a haul from here. And then you have to start getting into some of the West Virginia venues and some of the Indiana venues. So from a logistics standpoint, Columbus would appear to be in a really good spot in terms of a lack of competition.
Well, what are the expectations for the other sites, though? Toledo is going to be in direct competition with Detroit and Canada.
Yeah, the report shows that the expectations for Toledo are much more modest for a couple of reasons. Just as you said, the location and the proximity to everything going on in Detroit, the investments being made in the Toledo building, it's going to be located outside of downtown. It's basically off of the turnpike out there and near I-75. The Cleveland and Cincinnati casinos are interesting. They're pumping a ton of money into the Cleveland spot, and it's going to be a really nice building, and it's in a historic building in Cleveland, and of course you've got all the major professional sports franchises, so they expect to compete and make a lot of money there.
You're listening to Joe Varden from the Columbus Dispatch, and also with us is Professor Richard McGowan. He's an author and an economics professor at Boston College. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about casino gambling in the state of Ohio and the gambling issue in general. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go on to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and I'll post your question or comment there. There's a lot of suspicion out there, and I'm wondering, Professor, if this follows every new gambling venture as they open up around the country of corruption, that someone's paying somebody off, and that people are just very, very suspicious and distrustful.
Well, I mean, ironically, there's so much money involved now. Corruption is depending on how Ohio. I don't know exactly how Ohio is set up, whether they have a gaming commission, who's going to be issuing the licenses, and aspects like that, and even more what the tax rate is and things. But surprisingly, there has been very, very little corruption. Ironically, New Jersey has had casino gambling since 1978. They really have not had any really great issues. And again, I think the reason why is because now you have big multinational corporations like MGM, Harrah's, Sands—they're the big. They're the big players in this. Penn National is a smaller player. They usually do a lot of casinos, but they themselves are. In other words, there's you can't help but make money when you run a casino, and so it actually makes it pretty much unless the states don't set up a very good system of who gets the licenses, the corruption number really isn't really the big problem.
Yeah, Professor, I'll just jump in there because you raised some good points. They in Ohio, an Ohio Casino Control Commission has been established, and they are working through the very issues that you just brought up as far as making the rules for applying for a license, rules related to security at the casinos, related to who's allowed to work in them, related to things like should there be a central computer system for the entire for all the casinos, which actually that was a part of the deal with the casino operators that that a central system wouldn't be required, but they do appear to take the job seriously, and that there are some strict lobbying rules in effect for the Casino Control Commission. You know, it's funny you talk about New Jersey. I think the biggest news to come out of New Jersey gambling wise is somebody taking the house for what was it, a couple million bucks?
Yep.
By counting cards and blackjack. So yeah, so it seems like the corruption angle, you know, maybe there's not as much there as you might think.
Professor, following up on that domino effect issue, what's happening out in Las Vegas? How are they holding up, not only with this down economy, but with all this extra competition?
Well, one of the things that's happening in Vegas is, ironically, the number of visitors actually went up to Vegas. The amount that visitors are spending per capita is down. So it's an interesting thing for Vegas. I mean, Vegas definitely tries to still picture itself as the mecca of gambling, and there's so many more casinos. You know, in other words, it's just not one casino downtown. You have the Strip and all the entertainment and things like that. So it's being hurt, but in essence, what's really hurting them is that people are used to gambling now, and so they're not gambling as much out there, and they're going more to the shows. And so one of the interesting things in Las Vegas right now is less than 50% of the revenue that the casinos is actually gambling. It's much more on hotel rooms, entertainment, and eating and drinking.
But is gambling to Las Vegas what what liquor is to a restaurant? Sort of that's where the money is?
See, that's the interesting thing. One of the great myths now, there are no cheap meals now out in Las Vegas, and they have lowered the roommates because of the recession. So clearly, I'll say this much: the margin on gambling is certainly bigger than it is in any other thing. But they still are doing. I mean, I always find it fascinating that somebody would go out to Las Vegas to go shopping, but they do.
We're going to continue our conversation in a few minutes on gambling in Ohio and around the country, and how they affect each other, with our guest Joe Varden of the Columbus Dispatch, and also Professor Richard McGowan of Boston College. And coming up, we'll hear from Rob Walgate, Vice President for the American Policy Roundtable. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the game plan for Afghanistan. The president speaks, we'll debate the numbers and weigh the vision and the politics. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon, starting at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers are likely later today, especially after 4 o'clock this afternoon, a high of 78. More rain tonight and a low of 62 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
We are talking about gambling in Ohio. How's it going to work, and what with those two deals that the governor just cut with the two gambling companies now ensconced in the state of Ohio? Joining us to talk about that, Rob Walgate. He's vice president for the American Policy Roundtable. It's a public policy organization that works to make an impact on a wide range of policy issues. And Rob's been with the Ohio Roundtable an arm of that for 10 years. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, we hear that there is a lawsuit that has been threatened. Tell us exactly why the deals that the governor has cut with those two companies don't wash.
Well, there's a few reasons we've talked about litigation. One is obviously that voters approved in 2009 a constitutional amendment, and we don't feel the governor has the authority to work outside of the framework of what the voters approved. And when you dive into the agreement, we see some other things happening, such as the promise to put slot machines at 7 racetracks around the state of Ohio under the authority of the Lottery Commission. And Ohio voters approved the constitutional amendment in 1973 authorizing Ohio to run a state lottery, and we don't think in any way voters in 1973 envisioned they were authorizing slot machines at racetracks all across Ohio.
At what point in the process will you begin the litigation?
Well, we have to have standing in the court of law. Mm-hmm. Something has to happen, whether it be, statutory change from the legislature where they act upon something, whether it be maybe an additional payment that comes through from one of the casino corporations that isn't in the framework of the original agreement that happened in 2009. So it's forthcoming. It'll just take something to do. There needs to be a trigger mechanism.
Let's talk more about the commercial activity tax, and whether or not the casinos are actually, paying more when they're paying less of that.
Well, the governor said, I believe, 6 weeks ago, a month ago, something, he talked about implementing the CAT tax as it was written in the amendment, and the casinos having to pay the commercial activities tax on every dollar that was wagered. So every dollar that comes into a slot machine, every dollar that comes into a facility, that's very similar to every other business that operates in the state of Ohio. Now, according to the deal, there's going to be an exemption, and they will only have to pay it on their gross revenue, not their gross receipts. They won't have to pay it on every dollar that comes into the business. And that would be a carve-out and exemption, and they need some cooperation from the legislature to change that in statute. So, again, when the campaign happened, Penn and Rock and everybody else, I mean, no one talked about this carve-out for the CAT tax, but now that the deal has been made, now all these exceptions, they would like to see them made.
Joe Varden, what's the sense that the legislature, that this is going to roll through as easily as these agreements rolled through?
Well, it's funny because, Rob, of course, you're going to be at odds with the governor on most of these issues, but the administration would agree with you that that had they kept the CAT tax in place as it was originally worded in the budget, that it would have held up in court. I'm not sure about that, and virtually all of the gambling experts, and not to mention the casinos themselves, say that was simply a bluff, a bargaining chip, a ploy, that it wouldn't have held up in court. They surely would have sued. So in that regard, I would suggest it would be unrealistic to say that the state lost money by changing the CAT tax language. That indeed it was the hammer that brought the casinos to the table to get the extra $220 million. The other point, I guess, is that had the CAT tax language remained in place and had it survived a guaranteed legal challenge, it certainly would have taken away from the investments that would have been made in the casinos, and you might not have seen quite the finished product that you're going to see, which in the end could be argued would cost the state more as well.
Joe, two things on that. Number one, the casino lawyers obviously thought it was a real threat, or they would have never agreed to pay hundreds of millions of dollars more. So they can say what they want outside that realm, but they obviously thought that threat was real, that they would be forced to pay the full CAT tax. Number two, if those casinos wouldn't have been built the way they promised, again, we have to remember, the gambling industry and their lawyers wrote this language. We're not asking them to abide by anything that they didn't write. So to say it would have cost Ohio in the long run, I don't think it would have, because, these four facilities can be built the way they promised, but if they weren't built, someone else is going to come along and try and do this. And maybe, possibly, you know, there may not be a right way, I think, but many other people think there would be a better way to do this, especially financially. I mean, $50 million, you know, the governor talked about how that was too low of a licensing fee, and then he turns around and gives the racetracks the same exact deal when that's too low of a licensing fee. So I think the state is in the wrong, the administration's in the wrong, and they don't have the authority to do what they're doing, and they're cutting a bad deal for all of Ohio.
Well, what about the principal? I mean, no matter what kind of deal they're cutting, the issue, one of the issue has to be whether or not it's allowed to do what they're doing.
Absolutely, it has to be. Does this mean that the governor has the authority to work out of the framework on the Constitution for any deal that he wants on any issue that he wants? That is the big question. They've already done it on this one from 2009, and they're attempting to do it on the 1973 amendment as well as it pertains to the lottery.
I'm just curious, Robin, let me jump in. I'm curious as to how this is outside of the framework of the Constitution when the casinos are still required to pay the $50 million license fee, make a minimum investment that is actually on top of what is required in the Constitution,
right,
and the 33% tax.
Rob, let me jump in here a second. Is the Constitution a starting out point, or is it a total description of what is possible, or is it just a minimum?
No, it's not a minimum. It lays it out, and if I could, I have that language right in front of me, and I'm going to read a piece of. But what we have to remember, litigation took place in Columbus, or the threat of litigation. I know there was deposition hearings and everything else between Penn National and some other organizations on the premise of failed campaign promises, not living up to their end of the deal. Is that correct? Promises were made, and people didn't think they were delivered upon, so litigation came about, and I believe it was settled out of court. But what we have to remember is now we feel that Penn dropped the ball on campaign promises, some people in Columbus. But now we're looking to them to deliver on additional promises, that being the extra money. When we look at the exact language at the amendment, it says no other casino gaming-related state or local fees, taxes, or other charges, however measured, calculated, or otherwise derived, may be directly or indirectly applied to, levied against, or otherwise imposed upon gross casino revenue, casino operators, their operations, their owners, or their property. The casino lawyers may be sitting back and licking their chops saying, we can promise them the world, but guess what? According to the Ohio Constitution, we don't have to pay them a dime. They've already been sued once because they didn't deliver on promises. Now we're sitting back and saying, oh, that's all right. We'll forget about that. They're going to deliver this time.
I would suggest to you that if that happens, that would be an incredible story that I would certainly look forward to covering.
Professor McGowan, let me ask you. You know, we're in you know, just wrapped up in all of this contentiousness over lots of details regarding gambling in the state of Ohio, and have been really for many, many years. But since the constitutional amendment was passed, even more so. Is that the way it's gone in other states?
Almost every other state. Yeah. I mean, now in Massachusetts, it's not going to be a constitutional amendment. But ironically, in Massachusetts, it was the fight between the Speaker of the House and the governor. Remember, you got Democrats controlling everything in Massachusetts. But it's kind of interesting. The governor had visions of having three destination casinos because you're going to have economic development from it. Meanwhile, the Speaker of the House, he just wanted to put slot machines in the racetracks right by the Boston airport, and they were going to hopefully rake in the money from that and then let them morph into casinos. Same thing happened in Pennsylvania. There was huge fights about where you were going to put the casinos, how the licenses were going to be. I mean, so this is a familiar restraint from all over. And for instance, ironically, in Rhode Island, there's still a threat that the state of Rhode Island is going to take over one of the casinos there. And they're going to run it. They're going to run it through the lottery, which is I did chuckle when I heard that they're going to think about doing it through the lottery, because that's exactly what they did. And they actually used video lottery terminals and not slot machines. And video lottery terminals, believe it or not, the Supreme Court has ruled that video lottery terminals are not slot machines. So it's you cannot believe the legal wrangling that goes along with this.
Let's talk a little bit about the economic development issues. Have they come to New Jersey? Was Atlantic City? People said it turned into a garbage dump, that you had to walk into the doors and then you were in Furyland. But outside of that, it was a dump. The economic development didn't happen. What can a place like Ohio expect from all of that at this point in the game?
Revenue. It's revenue for the state. It's not going to be economic. It's not going to be for economic development. For the most part, unless you are the first casino in an area where you can get outsiders to come in. So, for instance, Zeed's two most successful Native American casinos were the ones that were established in Connecticut because they had a monopoly in Connecticut. And so all the other people for instance, one-third of the cars down there are from Massachusetts. Now, that's exactly why the Massachusetts legislature says we want to reclaim it. I think what was mentioned earlier, I think Columbus is a rather interesting spot, especially with all the college students around. I mean, you got Ohio State right there. It's rather interesting social policy to put a casino that near college students.
Is it that unusual?
Yeah, it is. It's very unusual. I mean, if you think about it, none of the other major casinos are not in a college town like that. No. I mean, now, granted, it's also the state capital, so Ohio is kind of an interesting combination there. But, I mean, yeah, there are casinos in Sacramento, but they're Native American casinos, and it's not a big college town, to say the least. But, no, I mean, it's rather interesting that you would put a casino in a town where a major university is.
Joe Vernon?
I was just going to say, Professor, that you must be talking about a major university, and Ohio State has, 50,000 students or something like that. If you look at the University of Cincinnati, is going to be very near the Cincinnati Casino, and they've got, 20,000 students.
Okay.
I'm not
That's
sure.
Interesting.
Cleveland State. You've got Case Western and Cleveland State right there. And then, of course, in Toledo, you have the University of Toledo, which is interesting because their football and basketball teams, some of their players got in quite a bit of trouble meeting a gambler in a casino in Detroit, and that meeting turned into a point-shaving scandal that really hurt the programs.
Mm. So. And if I may,
sure, Rob.
The professor talked about the economic development. I mean, we have to remember he talked about revenue for the state. And in this proposal, the revenue is not going to the state. It's going to the 88 different counties. But what was interesting is when the governor talked about the additional monies that had come in, once again, he has already picked the winners and the losers. He's picked food banks and some other things to give the money to. I'm not saying those aren't worthy causes to give money to. I'm saying, does the governor have the authority to just all of a sudden stand up and say, I'm going to tell you where this money's going to go? It seems like there's a lot of people being left out of the process. Most importantly, the people that are being left out of the process are the millions that voted in November of 2009 on this amendment.
Professor McGowan, is there any precedent out there for this kind of dealing where there's been a constitutional amendment and then there's been wheeling and dealing on top of that?
I haven't heard of it, I must say. I mean, it does seem like it seems like you're really opening up the floodgates. Usually it's a lot more gradual process. In other words, you start out with racinos putting slot machines in the racetracks, and then they morph into casinos, and then you have other casinos opening and things like that. So this is a lot more aggressive. I mean, I will say this much. Ohio is really – you're very aggressive. It's an aggressive policy, opening up casinos and then bringing the racetracks back in and things like that. So clearly there'll be some employment from these casinos, but you're also probably going to lose other jobs and other forms of entertainment. So the economic development question is – now, again, by the way, most gambling is used, the revenue is always used for the good cause. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania, by the way, all the gambling revenue is used for, right now, it's being used to subsidize for the elderly their property tax relief. So the elderly in Pennsylvania are getting checks to help pay their property taxes from the gambling revenue.
Could some of the biggest pushback regarding the lottery changes to the lottery come from people out there that voted for that in 1973, Rob? Joe? Rob?
I don't know if pushback will come from the actual people that voted on it. Pushback is going to come from people who understand the Constitution, who go to the Ohio Historical Society and do the research.
But how many are those? Yeah.
Which we have done. The problem is, just because something happened in 1973 and people don't remember it doesn't mean we can change the Constitution. There's a lot of things that have happened in the Ohio Constitution from 1803 forward. We can't change it on a whim, and that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly those out there who are saying that privatizing the Ohio lottery would be unconstitutional, and that is an issue that they're talking about right now in the Senate and House's Budget Conference Committee as to what to do about that.
Well, the usual thing is you put it to a vote, right? I mean,
if they want to do that, all they have to do is come up with a joint resolution, put it on the ballot for another constitutional amendment, and Ohioans would vote on it. And I don't think there would be any objection to that process of allowing people to vote on it. But think, we have to remember, if we are allowing the governor to implement these slot machines in racetracks all across the state of Ohio under the auspice of the Lottery Commission, that means that the governor has the authority to allow the Lottery Commission to put these slot machines anywhere he wants them across the state. There's going to be bar and restaurant owners that sue and want this. There's going to be convenience store owners. Again, he's picked the winners and the losers, and he is allowing them to only go in the racetracks when there's a lot of other lottery vendors that are saying, wait a minute here, how come we're not getting a piece of this pie? They're keeping 33%. Give us some of that.
Joe Varden, is Rob Walgate just giving people a bunch of ideas, or is there a sense out there that that might be the case?
Rob has absolutely no. Not just Rob, but the American Roundtable in general, not only very knowledgeable about the topic, but very passionate for it. I obviously have some questions about saying that the deal that the governor struck over the added $220 million is unconstitutional. As a reporter, I have some questions about that one. But I was at your press conference last week, and certainly, I mean, we wrote about it, and you certainly raise some interesting and good points that I imagine we'll be talking about more. So, you know, I mean, it's probably going to go
into the court of law. And again, we're not doing anything. People haven't heard from us in 18 months regarding this issue. We kind of stepped back and said, Ohioans have spoken. Let the casinos open in those four locations under the rules that they wrote. Problem is they didn't want to do that, and the governor didn't want them to do that.
Rob Walgate, Vice President of the American Policy Roundtable, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. And also Professor Richard McGowan of Boston College, thanks for helping us out today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck now.
Thank you. And Joe Varden of the Columbus Dispatch.
Hey, it was fun.
Thanks for being here. It's your first time on the show, and we appreciate you joining us. And thanks for listening. When we return, we're going to get some feedback on the president's speech last night about the pullout from Afghanistan. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
And this is 89.7 NPR News in 20 minutes beginning at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides discusses Shakespeare's enduring appeal and influences today in education, the media, and more. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 o'clock.
Support for 89.7 comes from Meijer, in partnership with the Nature Conservancy, protecting nature, preserving life. Non-invasive plants are available in the Meijer Garden Center. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
As an 89.7 NPR News listener, nobody knows more about our programs and core values than you. We'd love to hear how we are doing. This is your chance to give us direct feedback. Visit WOSU.org and take our brief survey. Thanks in advance for your time and for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 73 degrees currently. Expect some rain showers later today, especially after 4 o'clock this afternoon. Cloudy skies and a high of 78. More rain is likely tonight, a low of 62 degrees. There's a chance of rain for Friday, a high of 72. Looking ahead to Saturday, sunshine and a high of 76. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
President Obama last night announced that 10,000 U.S. troops will exit Afghanistan by January and another 23,000 by late next summer, eventually leaving behind 68,000 to hold down the fort until Afghan forces take over in 2014.
When I announced this surge at West Point, we set clear objectives to refocus on al-Qaeda, to reverse the Taliban's momentum, and train Afghan security forces to defend their own country.
Joining us today to review the president's announcement is Peter Mansour. He is the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair in Military History at Ohio State University. His research interests include modern U.S. military history, World War II, the Iraq War, and counterinsurgency warfare. Peter also is a highly decorated officer with more than 26 years of distinguished military service. And before coming to Ohio State, he served as executive officer to General David Petraeus, then commander of the multinational forces in Iraq. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
Great to be on, Ann.
So it was only a 10-minute speech. Any surprises there?
No surprises. I guess I was a little disconcerted that by the summer of 2012, President Obama is going to withdraw the surge forces right in the middle of a campaign season there in Afghanistan. I couldn't really figure out militarily the reason for it, and then I figured out it wasn't a military reason. It was a political reason so that he could trumpet the drawdown during his presidential reelection bid.
President Obama says also that next May in Chicago, he will host a summit with NATO allies to shape the next phase of this transition. Let's listen.
As we strengthen the Afghan government and security forces, America will join initiatives that reconcile the Afghan people, including the Taliban. Our position on these talks is clear. They must be led by the Afghan government, and those who want to be a part of a peaceful Afghanistan must break from al-Qaeda, abandon violence, and abide by the Afghan Constitution.
So is this politics, too, having this meeting and really right about the same time?
No, I think he's trying to keep NATO together and on board. The problem with what he said is it's mutually exclusive. As you withdraw forces from Afghanistan, the Taliban is going to be less likely, not more likely, to negotiate. And the conditions he set for them reentering politics in Afghanistan are unacceptable to the Taliban, to include abiding by the Afghan Constitution, which they abhor. So I really, strategically, the president's way forward doesn't make a lot of sense. Politically, for domestic consumption, it does.
The president said that we should take comfort in the fact that the tide of war is receding. Is that a premature suggestion that the tide of war is receding?
Very much so. Now, we have made some substantial progress in Kandahar and Helmand provinces, but that was due to the surge and due to the military operations that are taking place there. To expect that those gains are going to stay and solidify as we withdraw our forces is premature and, I think, optimistic.
My guest is retired Army Colonel Peter Mansour. He's also a professor of military history at Ohio State University. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for Professor Mansour. A spokesman for the Afghanistan Defense Ministry says that Afghans are ready for the U.S. exit, but then others say that it's strengthening enemy morale. So which is it, or a little of both, or what?
Our operations in the last couple of years since President Obama agreed to more fully resource General Petraeus' strategy there have dealt great blows to the Taliban. Their morale isn't really high right now. In the past year alone, we've taken off the battlefield several thousand of their mid-level leaders with night raids and drone strikes and so forth. And we've taken away their heartland in the Pashtun areas of Kandahar and Helmand. So we've made great strides. But war is a contest of wills, and they may see our will breaking now as President Obama accelerates this transition, perhaps earlier than he needed to.
Last night, President Obama said Afghan security forces have grown by more than 100,000 troops, and in some areas, responsibility for security has been transferred.
Well, that's all true. And General Caldwell and the folks in the NATO training mission in Afghanistan are doing great work. But as we saw in Iraq, it takes years to build up a competent military force. And we've only, again, fully resourced this effort in the last year or two. So we need to give them time to grow the force and make it better quality as well. 2014 is the goal, but we're going to have a bridge to get there, and that bridge is U.S. and NATO forces. And again, the president, you know, should be advised not to withdraw them too quickly. Of course, he has announced a withdrawal already of the surge troops by the middle of 2012. Like I said, right in the middle of a campaign season there, summer campaign season next year.
Getting those the Afghan security forces ready, in reading about that, there's been a lot of talk about the literacy levels, things like that. They're so pitifully low that there's no way they can get them up to speed for years and years, as you mentioned. What is our standard for the Afghan security forces compared to the U.S. military?
I think the standard could be encapsulated in two words, good enough. You mentioned literacy, for instance. The percentage of Afghan forces who come in literate is about 15%. Literacy training is part of their basic training, and with the goal of getting them to a sixth grade reading level, so that they can at least do the basics that military operations in a counterinsurgency environment call for. Again, this takes time. I don't know that it takes years with each individual troop. Mm-hmm. But it's more important to grow the leadership. It takes a long time to get competent officers in charge of these formations.
Dale in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Ann, this is Dale Butlin in the interest of full disclosure, but I'm not calling in on behalf of Innovation Ohio today. I have a couple of graduate degrees in international relations, so I have an interest in the subject. So here's my question, or really my point, I guess, and then a question. The professor indicated a short time ago that the president's announcement of the drawdown of the troops doesn't make a lot of sense from a strategic point of view. I think you can take another look at this and suggest that it makes a lot of strategic sense on this basis. We've been at war now for about 10 years, 2.5 times longer than we were at war in World War II. All of the public opinion polls show there's a war weariness among the public. It's costing us about $10 billion a month at a time when everybody knows we're broke. Every war must end. It makes one wonder how long you can sustain what we're doing there in the face of public opposition to the war. If we should have learned anything from Vietnam, is that you can't sustain a war that the public doesn't support. So I wonder if the good professor would comment on that.
Peter Mansour?
Yeah, my experience during the surge in Iraq, when, again, the public opinion polls were even more sharply inclined for withdrawal from the country, and, in fact, the president and his party lost the midterm elections of 2006, every political wind was blowing against George W. Bush, and yet he ordered the surge anyway. My experience is that a president can drive forward foreign policy to include participation in a war for a long time before Congress will act to pull the plug. And I think we're a long, long way from that in Afghanistan. The cost is over $100 billion a year, but given that we have a $1.4 trillion deficit, the war is a very, very minute portion of what ails this country economically. And I think in looking at it strategically, what we want to leave behind is a stable situation in which Afghanistan doesn't fall apart upon our withdrawal. The Taliban take over, and then we're right back to where we were before 9/11 with a hostile state in the middle of Central Asia that could become a safe haven for terrorists.
Thanks to Dale Butlin for the comment. Dale's former very closely worked with former U.S. Senator John Glenn for many years. Matt in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, did you say Matt?
I did, Matt. Thanks.
Oh, okay. So I guess my comment would be that the professor said a couple minutes ago that Obama is pulling out troops next year for campaign reasons, and that might be entirely true. I have no idea. But it just seems like he's in a tight spot because, you know, he's being attacked for doing this for political reasons, but if he went ahead and said, no, we need the troops to stay in, then he would be attacked for keeping troops in and not fulfilling his campaign promise from a year ago or whatever it was. So, you know, he's damned if he does, he's damned if he doesn't.
The eternal struggle, right, Professor Mansour?
Sort of, because had he said, well, I'm going to leave the additional 20,000 troops there through the campaign season in 2012, they would have been withdrawn perhaps several months later than his timeline. And they would have done a lot of good in that campaign season next year, and yet still they would have fulfilled his campaign promise, just not before the election. I think a president, he's the leader of the country, he's got to think strategically and for the good of the country, and I just don't see why he couldn't have allowed those troops to remain several more months, other than thinking re-election rather than thinking what was best for the mission over there.
So, Professor, how does a drawdown like this shift the tactics in the war?
Well, one of the things operationally, when I was over in Afghanistan last December at the request of General Petraeus to take a look at things, it was clear that we were making headway in the south, east of the country, in Kandahar and Helmand, and that the next step was going to be extending that counterinsurgency campaign north and east into Regional Command East, which is a really, really difficult area near Jalalabad and the vicinity there. The withdrawal of the surge forces makes that impossible. So what's going to happen tactically now is there's going to be a lot of night raids and drone strikes and a more of a counter-terrorist approach to combating the Taliban in Regional Command East. And any extension of a fully blown counterinsurgency campaign into that area is dead.
From Paul on Facebook, he writes, I didn't like the speech when Bush gave it, and I liked it even less from Obama. Can you please ask Professor Mansour why we are to care about the Taliban now that we have decapitated al-Qaeda?
Well, that's a good point. If the Taliban took over Afghanistan, if we could be assured that there would be no repercussions to our national security from that, then I would agree with him. I just, in my study of the situation, it's clear to me that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are linked at the hip. And I really don't think that a Taliban victory in Afghanistan is in our national interest. Now, having said that, it is very, very difficult for us to continue to support the kind of corrupt regime that Hamid Karzai represents. I think the way forward there is, we have got to be planning for what happens after 2014, the next presidential election that will bring Hamid Karzai's successor to power, and what our troop presence and what our security presence will be in Afghanistan for the long haul, so that we can stabilize that part of the world rather than having it continue to be this sore spot that continues to bite us every so often, and sometimes in a big way.
What's the lot of those who are left behind by next January? And then after that, next August?
The U.S. forces?
Yes.
Left behind? Well, they're going to continue to perform their duties. More and more of them will focus on training the Afghan security forces and partnering with them as we hand over the mission to the Afghan army and police. But U.S. troops are still going to be doing counterinsurgency in Helmand and Kandahar provinces. They're still going to be doing counter-terror raids and so forth. There's just going to be a lot fewer of our troops. So we're going to have to pick and choose our spots. We're not going to be able to have the kind of comprehensive approach that we have at present.
Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm Fred Cass. I'm 66. And the corporate rates and the rates for millionaires and billionaires in this country is so artificially low for us doing this kind of military activity. We need to pull all the troops home. You cannot. So to pay for this, they have now said Medicare and Social Security are on top. They're not entitlements. We put that money in, and we're not getting our money back. We're not going to get our health care, and we're not going to get our retirement. Why? Because of some possibility.
Okay, Fred, you're going to have to lower. Fred, you're going to have to lower. Okay, Fred, you have to lower your voice because the static, and you also have to turn down your radio so we can hear you properly. I'm going to put you back on.
To raise the money for these wars.
Okay. Okay. Peter, that's.
Yeah. I mean, it's a standard refrain from a portion of the political spectrum that these wars have caused the fiscal catastrophe that the United States is facing. But I would just like to throw on the table some facts. We have a $1.4 trillion deficit. The wars are costing us about $100 to $120 billion a year. You could eliminate the entire Department of Defense and still not have the budget deficit in the United States. So I would take exception to what the caller says, that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are not the issues when it comes to the debt and deficit of the United States. They are the issue, along with taxes, because revenue is part of the equation. But, you know, $100 to $120 billion a year, it's a lot of money. I agree. And you can argue that it should be used for other things, but don't argue that you can solve the budget deficit by ending these wars, because you cannot.
Peter Mansour, he's professor at Ohio State University of Military History. He's also a retired Army colonel and a frequent guest on the show whenever something like this happens. And I appreciate every time you join us, Peter.
Well, thank you, Anne.
Thank you for listening. We'll be following the story as it evolves. If you have any questions or comments about it and you want to talk about it some more, you can go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook, and you can also comment at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.